Now, I am going to say the four magic words that is guaranteed to strike terror in the hearts of law students everywhere. I need four volunteers. Who's brave enough out there? This isn't going to hurt. Good. We have one. Two, three, four. All right, come on up. We will be performing some not very painful anatomical experiments. They won't be hurt in the making of this episode much. Okay. Well, you're very brave. Thank you. It will be very painless, I promise you. Over 100 years ago, a fascinating little lady by the name of Ellen White penned these words: "Transgression has almost reached its limit. Confusion fills the world, and a great terror is soon to come upon human beings. The end is very near. We who know the truth should be preparing for what is soon to break upon the world as an overwhelming surprise." Now, my four brave volunteers, I'm going to give you a hypothetical, and at the end of it, I'm going to ask you what you would do in this circumstance. We have three guys and one gal. So, Mr. and Ms. Special Agents, you have now been promoted. Let me grab this microphone. I've catch your names now and promptly forget them and have to ask you again. All right. Your name is Grace. And is this microphone on or off? It doesn't seem like it's on. Should be. All right. Well, say it again.
No.
Grace.
Grace.
All right. And let's see, your name, we have Grace and
Paul.
Paul, thank you.
Don.
Charles. All right, Grace, Paul, Don, and Charles. Well, congratulations. You have all been promoted to the status of special agent with our Federal Bureau of Investigation. You are now FBI agents, and what if you knew, each one of you, that there another September 11 attack was imminent? Somewhere within this great nation, within 24 hours, thousands of Americans were going to die. Suppose further that you had just arrested somebody with papers in his possession that proved he knew all about the plan. The papers even told you when the attack would occur, but not where or how. The person sitting in front of you does know that. All you know is something awful is about to happen. You question the prisoner, and he refuses to talk. And just like a good Hollywood movie, the clock is ticking. 24 hours, 23 and a half, 22. Less than a day, and we are going to go through the agony of September 11 all over again. But this guy in front of you knows. He knows where it's going to happen and how it's going to be done. If he were to talk, you know you could stop the problem. You question him again. He sneers at you this time, being a very unfriendly sort, says, "I want my lawyer," and says nothing. He's a very smart man, by the way. What are you going to do? In the Middle Ages, people knew exactly what they were going to do. They had an array of devices designed to make people talk. Just stay there. I'll get back to you in a second. Let me give you a few examples. One was an iron casket. It was called the Iron Maiden, and it was filled with sharp spikes. If you imagine just an iron casket with spikes sticking out from every which angle, the way this particular device was employed, they would stick the unfortunate man or woman into this thing and then close the door. I leave to your imagination what happened to the person inside. And there was usually an eye slit so you could see the eyes of the person inside as this was happening to them. Another charming device they came up with. How many of you know what a sawhorse is? You know that thing that sits, okay, it sits on braces and it's just basically a piece of wood. Well, our charming forebears in the Middle Ages had come up with a device where that crossbeam was made of metal, very sharp metal. It came up to a sharp edge like a knife. And a person would be set down on that thing with their feet about 6 inches off the ground, and then weights would be hung on their ankles and placed on their shoulders, forcing them down on it until they talked. Another prospect that was always present, if none of these inducements worked, was being burned at the stake. As I say, they were nice people. So this was the way people in the Middle Ages got information. This is the way they made people talk. In the Middle Ages, people played tough. Torture. Throughout most of human history, it has been routinely used to extract cooperation from people society feared. And then, along came a document signed one September day in 1787. We, the people of the United States, in order to form a more perfect union, establish justice, ensure domestic tranquility, promote the general welfare, provide for the common defense, and secure to ourselves and to our posterity the blessings of liberty, do hereby ordain and establish this Constitution. And immediately following the signing of that document, 10 amendments were passed. Congress shall pass no law respecting the establishment of religion or prohibiting the free exercise thereof. The right of the people to be secure in their persons, houses, papers, and effects against unreasonable searches and seizures shall not be infringed. Excessive bail shall not be required, nor shall cruel and unusual punishment be inflicted. For generations, the Bill of Rights, my four special agents, has protected people from what happened in the Inquisition. But suddenly our nation is facing terrorism, death from within, terrorists hiding in the shadow of the very constitutional rights they seek to destroy. We've never faced a challenge like this before, and the survival not only of thousands of people, but ultimately of the very nation in which we live, is at stake. And now, with the full majesty of that document before you, you find yourself as federal officers weighing the equities. This life or those lives? Thousands of them, among whom are women and children, who will die if your suspect does not talk. This sneering prisoner's rights, or their rights, rights as basic as sheer survival. Right to be free from such things as fear, freedom from fear. You put each of these competing alternatives in the balance pans of the scales of justice, and now, Mr. or Ms. Federal Officer, what are you going to do? We'll start at the other end since you introduced yourself. How's that? Because you look like the smartest. Keep going. You're doing fine. This is not an easy question. You have a prisoner sitting in front of you. I am that prisoner. I am refusing to tell you where or how this event is going to happen. You know when. I'm not telling you. What's your solution? I'll make it easy for you. You can torture me, or you can uphold my constitutional rights. Good for you. That's in return for how I just tortured him. All right, here we go. What's your vote? Torture or leave me be? Thousands of lives on the line here. Don't make a dumb decision. You don't know where or how, you just know when. You know it will happen.
I think like things like random city and just freaking out, then you know it's that city.
Well, that's a very insightful thought, but we're going to stick with my list of choices since they make it much easier for me. What do you do? Torture or no? Just as a person, as a Christian, what choice do you make?
As a person or as a Christian?
As both.
As both. Well, torture's gonna work. So, you witness to him.
You witness to him. All right. Next.
The first thing I would do is I'd be really, really nice to him, first of all.
Mm-hmm.
And
so you're not going to torture me.
Well, that's first, starting off.
All right.
And then if that didn't work, I would offer him, a lot of cash.
Mm-hmm.
If that didn't work.
Well, you have the treasury at your back.
Exactly. They're printing.
They shell money from people all the time. You can do that.
If that didn't work and time was running out, I'd start torturing him.
But so you would use torture. All right.
Then I'd try to find his family.
Ah, well, that's unusually insightful. Well, let's see. We have three up for torture. Now, this is our potential to get a different perspective. What would you do? Pardon?
If I pick the rights, because he has the rights to saying that I don't want to tell him stuff, right?
Mm-hmm. That's what the Constitution says. But remember, what you're basically weighing here is his constitutional rights, this magnificent document, versus thousands of American lives. What choice do you make?
Probably torture him.
Probably torture. All right. Thank you very much. You can all go back to your seats. You did wonderfully. Well, you are in very good company. If your solution to that problem is torturing the prisoner, you are in probably some of the most distinguished company in the legal community. One of our leading constitutional scholars gave exactly the same answer. His name is Alan Dershowitz. Anybody here heard of him? The Alan Dershowitz, Harvard Law professor, lifelong advocate of constitutional rights, member of the O.J. Simpson Dream Team. Guess what? Professor Dershowitz suggests we ought to institutionalize torture. In a recent book entitled Shouting Fire, Dershowitz says that we should establish in our legal system something called a torture warrant. Now, you've heard of search warrants. Torture warrants are something a bit different. To state the obvious. The torture warrant would allow a judge to oversee the necessary torture of a prisoner. If someone reasonably seems to have information needed to save thousands of innocent lives, Professor Dershowitz says federal agents can go to a federal judge, explain the necessity of the torture, and get a court's approval to do so. Well, he goes on. He doesn't stop there. He's a very bright man. And so, being the bright man that he is, he suggests specific ways in which we can go about torturing people. One of them is the use of, guess what? Needles, which would be driven under the suspect's fingernails. But don't worry, we're going to use sterilized needles so they don't get an infection, because we wouldn't want that, would we? It's just not the American way. Or, he suggests, we could use a technique employed by the Israelis, which is putting a bag soaked in some foul-smelling substance, which he doesn't say what that is, soaked in some foul-smelling substance over the head of the suspect, and then play rock music in his ears until he cracks. Believe me, it works. This from a man who has spent a lifetime and a career as a champion for the Bill of Rights. It gives you the four responses that we got this evening, as well as Professor Dershowitz's suggestion, give you some idea of just how serious the problem is that we face. Let's talk for a few moments this evening about the Bill of Rights. We will be talking about five specific things. And I'll outline them on the board as we get there. We're going to talk about privacy rights, profiling, military tribunals, which you've probably heard something about. We'll talk very briefly about the Patriot Act and four or five of the really egregious abridgments that act has brought into the federal system. And finally, we'll talk about religious freedom and where we are in this country in terms of the classic Sherbert test for a wall of separation between church and state. Let's start out by asking ourselves a fairly generic question. In an emergency, do nations suspend liberty? Absolutely. Of course they do. In the Civil War, just 2 weeks after Fort Sumter was fired on, President Lincoln sent an order to General Winfield Scott up at Fort McHenry in Maryland, telling him that if it was necessary, if it looked like Maryland was going to secede from the Union, he could choose at his pleasure to bombard random Maryland cities until Maryland decided to come back into the Union. Fortunately, that never had to happen. Lincoln also authorized the suspension of something called habeas corpus. Now, let me get myself some room on the board here, and let's talk just a little bit about what some commentators have, I think, rightly called the most powerful of all writs. We have a very fine lawyer in the group tonight, and I am going to ask her if she feels like it to take a stab at defining habeas corpus for us. She doesn't feel so inclined. It's not surprising. It's a very obscure writ in certain practice areas. If you don't do criminal law, a lot of people don't know that much about it. It is an amazingly powerful writ. Habeas corpus is Latin for "you have the body," and it basically allows a federal court to compel the mightiest government agency to turn over a prisoner that they're holding. In other words, if you're the FBI, you are holding a prisoner, you're the INS, you're holding a prisoner, a federal court can, on a petition for habeas corpus, writ of habeas corpus, send a command to that agency to release the prisoner into their custody until they can determine the constitutionality or the legality of his continued confinement. So, if you were wrongly accused of murdering your child, you were in your home, someone broke in, strangled your son, you ran in and tried to render first aid, you had your fingerprints all over his neck, et cetera, doesn't look good, they can't find the other perp, they can't find evidence he was there, you go to jail, you can bring a petition for habeas corpus, you can say I'm being unjustly held, and literally, the court can command that the agency, whatever agency is holding you, deliver you up into the jurisdiction of the court. This thing is so ancient that King John even accepted it as part of the Magna Carta. It's been around a long, long time. Very powerful writ, yet in the Civil War, at the height of the Civil War, Abraham Lincoln suspended that writ, provoking the worst constitutional crisis in the history of this country. General Scott, the same guy that had been at Fort Sumter and Lincoln had ordered to bombard Maryland cities, promptly scooped up, after the Civil War started, promptly scooped up a guy by the name of Merryman. Now, Merryman was a Southern sympathizer. He had been a secessionist drill company officer, and so, in other words, the man was a potential terrorist threat to the Union cause. Mr. Merryman is arrested by General Scott, who holds him, of all places, in Fort McHenry. Now, I know there's a couple of history people out there. What's so important about Fort McHenry? Anybody remember that place? Yep. Did I hear some answer out there? Let me give you a little hint. The Star Spangled Banner, all right? Does it ring any bells now? Francis Scott Key. Fort Sumter was the fort that was under fire during the War of 1812. Francis Scott Key, sitting out on a British warship, looks in towards this Pentagon-shaped fort, this bastion of American pride, there at the entrance to Baltimore Harbor. And he sees throughout the night this battered, torn American flag, occasionally illuminated by hot cannon shot as it came over, still flying proudly. Nobody thought the fort could survive the bombardment. It did, and in the first gray light of dawn, Mr. Key sat down on the deck of that British warship and penned into immortality what has become our national anthem. And in one of the greater ironies of the Civil War, General Scott seized Mr. Merryman and held him in custody at Fort McHenry. Well, Mr. Merryman, not having any sense of humor about being so ill-treated, brought a habeas corpus petition. He petitioned Chief Justice Taney of the United States Supreme Court, and he said, they can't do this to me because as long as civil courts are functioning, the use of, and note this phrase, the use of military tribunals is improper. Are you following me? So long as there is a civil court system, the federal courts that you see in your hometown or in New York when you go to visit there, so long as those things are still functioning, you cannot use military tribunals in this country against civilians. Well, that order went to General Scott, who promptly forwarded it to President Lincoln. And when the federal marshal tried to serve the order on the general, who then sent it to Lincoln, Lincoln said, "Oh, no, you can't. We're not going to give you the prisoner." That bounced up back up to the United States Supreme Court. The United States Supreme Court said, "Mr. President, you cannot do that. You cannot take away this court's power to issue a writ of habeas corpus." The decision came down. Mr. Lincoln said, "You've made your ruling. I have the army. Now, why don't you try to enforce it?" That is the only time in the history of this country when a sitting United States president has defied an order of the United States Supreme Court. Huge, huge structural problem in our government, because if you remember from your American civics class, our government has a tripartite structure. There are three co-equal branches of government. There's the president, there's the Congress, and there's the Supreme Court. There's the judiciary. Each one of those is co-equal, and the Supreme Court, per longstanding constitutional doctrine, McCulloch v. Maryland, has the power to determine what the Constitution says, Marbury v. Madison. All right? Lincoln says you can't do that. He defies the Supreme Court, and prisoner, Mr. Merriman, ended up being tried before a military tribunal, as did thousands more Confederate prisoners who were detained, held, and tried before military tribunals rather than before the civil courts of this nation. One commentator described this as one of the lowest points for civil rights in American history. In times of crisis, nations suspend liberty. The same thing happened at other times of crisis in this country. World War I, President Woodrow Wilson made it a crime to criticize the draft, which, of course, the Supreme Court has since held during the turbulent Vietnam era is a First Amendment right of anyone who wishes to criticize draft laws. World War II, a couple of cases you need to be familiar with, and in fact, from talking with you, I know that several of you are. World War II comes along. We are again facing a very easily profiled enemy. We know that the enemy in this case, or at least the one that attacked at Pearl Harbor, is Japanese. There's a fairly limited number of them in this country. They are interred in concentration camps, mostly located in the state of Arizona. About 120,000 of them are taken out of their homes, deprived of liberty, and held for the duration of the war. A man by the name of Mr. Korematsu said, "You can't do this to me. I am a United States citizen. I have rights." He appealed all the way to the United States Supreme Court, who said, "Oh, no, you don't. This is a time of war. This is within the power of the government." And even though the Supreme Court would later reverse itself, that once again stands as a low watermark of American constitutional law. When times of crisis come, your rights as an American, your constitutional protections as a religious or an ethnic minority, can go right out the window. One other quick example of that, again stemming from World War II, Minersville v. Gobitis, Minersville School District. Mr. Gobitis was a little Mormon kid, or Latter-day Saint kid, who refused to salute the flag on religious reasons. He was kicked out of school. His parents brought an action saying you need to have him reinstated. The Supreme Court said, no, we can compel people to salute the flag. Thank you very much. This is World War II. We all have a wonderful sense of patriotism, and if you can't get the spirit, you just don't have to go to our schools. Minersville v. Gobitis, again, a case that has since been overruled by the court, but demonstrating, both of these cases demonstrate that ethnic and religious minorities are persecuted in this country and have been in times of crisis. Now, what is happening today? Let's go through fairly briefly, because I want to have some time for questions, Five areas in which we have seen amazing changes in the last few months since September 11. And we are going to start in the area of privacy. Fourth Amendment, magnificent constitutional guarantee against the ability of a government, as they did during the Inquisition, to come into your house, to take you out in the middle of the night with no showing of cause, and to torture you until you confess to a crime you didn't commit. Right to privacy. Rights of the people to be secure in their persons, houses, papers, and effects against unreasonable searches and seizures shall not be infringed. But terrorism has forced us to make a quantum leap in abridging this power. We have now granted to federal agencies broad new wiretap privileges, which allows agencies like the FBI to tap people, not phone lines. Now, classically, you would have to get a warrant for one phone line. Let's use an example. Let's say that you are engaged in drug smuggling. Yeah, you're a nice person. It's just, you know, a little extra cash on the side. I am a very nice federal agent who says I'm going to put you in jail. And I go to a federal judge, and I need evidence. I don't have enough evidence to arrest you yet. If I can get you on the phone saying I am going to bring drugs into this country, then under 18 U.S.C. 959, I can bring you back here and I can try you. So I get on the phone to a federal judge. I say, Your Honor, you know, we have seen her driving a car with Florida license plates up to Washington, D.C. She carries American tourist or luggage. She looks suspicious. We begin outlining the profile factors for the drug runner profile. The judge says, okay, I see your point. You want to tap her Virginia phone line, 703-555-1212. Okay, I will grant you a warrant for that, but, oh, change the facts. She not only has a line in Virginia, she also has phone lines in Florida, and she has a cell phone. Now, she wises up. She's a very smart person, and she knows that I'm probably doing this, and so she does not do any one deal on one of her phone lines. She uses all three of them, and I can't follow her around. My warrant is specific to that one phone line. She can change lines and throw me off the track. This is out. New legislation allows federal agencies to track people with warrants, not specific phone lines. Which can lead to some interesting abridgments of liberty, because let's say that as a federal agent, I've got her phone number wrong. I think she has a cell phone, but in fact, that cell phone belongs to somebody else. I tap in on you and record hours of uninteresting conversations between you and your boyfriend. Abridgment of your right to privacy, certainly, but within the scope of the new warrant, I'm allowed to do that so long as I have a reasonable belief that she is using that phone line. All right? Major shift, because no longer do I have to actually establish that phone line belongs to her. Let's talk about something else called Magic Lantern. A big thing today is internet and computer encryption. It's a way of avoiding federal or any other type of invasive or invasion of your privacy, where every time you type something into a computer, the file is saved in an encrypted format so that a snooping federal agent can't read it. Magic Lantern is a program developed by the FBI. It's a Trojan horse which they insert into your computer, recognizes your keystrokes before the computer encrypts them, and allows them to pull out the message, literally snatching it right out of the encryption system before it goes in and is encrypted beyond recognition. Carnivore is something that generated a lot of controversy last year. If we believe what they're telling us, it's died a natural death, or it's at least their efforts are being made to stop it. Basically, what carnivore does, if you visit a federal website, perhaps you're interested in federal employment, you visit the FBI website, they insert a cookie in your computer which tracks your later computer usage. If your next website visit is www.footfetish.com, the FBI has a record of where you've been, when you were there, and how long you stayed. Nasty program, and something that Congress got rather exercised about, and they're attempting to stop it. Lastly, talking about privacy, let's talk about airport screening devices. Now, you've all seen probably something on the news about the new airport security. We are now profiling to a certain extent, or certain commentators urging we do profile passengers in airports looking for a terrorist profile. Certainly a large factor in that would be national origin profiling. Airport devices are being tested right now, which are so intrusive of your privacy that they can literally see through your clothes. The models who tested these things had to wear special underwear to avoid displaying their inadequacies to the world. This is very, very intrusive stuff. Once again, probably necessary given the weaponry that we saw employed on September 11th. But the type of thing that your average church-going grandmother would probably not be happy to know was in existence. All of which brings up what's probably the most interesting point in all of the invasion of privacy issues, and that is information sharing. Now, I've had the chance to either talk with or hear presentations by a lot of very senior people at the Department of Justice, including Michael Chertoff, who is the head of the Criminal Division at the Department of Justice, as well as Mr. Larry Thompson, who heads up the terrorism section of the Criminal Division. And they both told me that the biggest advances made in post-September 11th law enforcement is information sharing, which is a much scarier thought than it would initially appear, because each piece of the federal government has some little chunk of your life. You know, you buy a car, and state has the, whatever state you buy it in has DMV records. The Federal Bureau of Alcohol, Tobacco, and Firearms has certainly some records of your gun ownerships if you own certain Class 3 or destructive device weapons. Certainly other agencies such as Social Security have other pieces of information about you, such as your contributions to Social Security, your earnings, etc. The problem is all of this information is scattered among a bunch of very diverse federal agencies. If you're very lucky, you may even have an FBI file on you if you've ever participated in what are classified as anti-American organizations. All of that stuff up to this point has been specific to the agency. What you have to understand about the agencies in Washington are they're like a pack of junkyard dogs. You know, each one has its territory. They love to chew on their scraps, and they won't let any other dog anywhere near their scraps. They're always at each other's throats. And so up to now, that information has been very agency-specific. After the 11th, those walls came down. The barriers have dropped. Agencies are now freely sharing information on people. So any one person in any one agency can have a fairly complete picture of your life simply by linking through IntelLink or some other federal intranet service, linking into the other agencies and doing a search on you. They are working on compiling a central database now of information which will have basically your entire life history on it. From there, it is a very short step to a national identity card. Our friends up to the north, up in Canada, have already done something like that. They call it the maple leaf, ironically enough. I think they call everything up there the maple leaf, including their money, or at least their gold money. And that maple leaf card is basically a national identity card. It has all of your information on it. It's a smart card. I don't, unfortunately, have one with me to show you, but it has a little computer chip in it, which can store over 100 pages of information, your medical records, your driver's license info, your firearms ownership, et cetera, your employment history. All of that stuff goes on one card, which becomes you. And if at any point you are perceived as a threat or people want to cut you off from the system, without that card, you literally don't exist. You get, in essence, voted off the island. We are already seeing the first hints of that in this country where you, for instance, can't rent a car if you don't have a credit card. You really do not want to try to buy an airline ticket for cash unless you want some friendly gentleman from the FBI knocking on your door. If you try, you will discover the length, depth, and width of the word profiled. The government is not taking very kindly to those types of activities today. And as I pointed out, in a troubled future, that same technician can control who buys and who sells, which, if you want to just very quickly turn in your Bibles to Revelation 13, is exactly what John, so many centuries ago, told us would happen. And he exercises all the power of the first beast before him and causes the earth and them which dwell therein to worship the first beast. And he doeth great wonders, so that he maketh fire come down from heaven on the earth in the sight of men, etc., etc. This is the type of thing we're looking at. Skip down to verses 16 and 17. He causes all, both small and great, rich and poor, free and bond, to receive a mark in their right hand or in their foreheads, so that nobody might buy or sell, save he that had the name, the mark, or the number. All right? The technology is there. The incentive is there. It's simply a matter of how long it's going to take us to get there. Let's move on and let's talk very briefly about profiling. If you think about it, as one card-carrying member of the NAACP said on a radio talk show not that long ago, the hijackers on September 11 all had one characteristic in common. And now, just to make sure that you're still awake out there, let me ask you what that was. Every single one of them had one thing in common. What was it? They were all Middle Eastern, exactly. And as this gentleman pointed out, you're looking at 100%. It's not 90, it's not even 99. 100% of the men who flew into the World Trade Center were Islamic Middle Easterners who can very easily be profiled. And it really, at this point, the question becomes, can you effectively counter radical Islamic terrorism without profiling? It's a serious question. It's one that certainly gets the backs of a lot of civil libertarians up, but the numbers are fairly simple. In this country, there are roughly 6,000 Middle Eastern men between the age of 18 and 35. That is your enemy, in a nutshell. If the threat is going to come, the theory is it will come from one of those 6,000 men. It's a small group. It's a very visible minority. The very group from which terror struck. The argument is it not illogical to not recognize this very logical profile because it works, or at least it would have worked on the 11th. But notice that this profile, whatever you think of profiling, and I am not supporting that in any way, it's one of the sadder pages in our country's history that we ever engaged in that sort of thing. 6,000 Middle Eastern men, whatever you think of that, notice that that profile is also a what? A religious one. Now, while it is easy to justify that when you're dealing with people who are trying to take your life, what does Revelation say will happen at the end of time? And he had power to give life unto the image of the beast and cause all that as many as would not worship the image of the beast should be killed. The profile that Revelation describes is all the people who would not worship in accordance with the majority view. Revelation foresees a religious profile. Folks were already employing one. Now, does that mean we shouldn't actively defend ourselves against murderous terrorists? Absolutely not. But notice, the devil is cleverly programming the world mind to adopt the very measures Revelation says will be directed against God's people at the end of time. We are seeing Revelation happen on the headlines in front of us. All we have to do is open our eyes to what's happening. Okay, let's talk for just a few minutes about the military tribunals. Very briefly, I don't want to spend a lot of time on this. If there's specific questions, I can answer them in the Q&A session. Let me just basically outline what those things are. It is, for all practical purposes, an alternative system of justice to the one we have. Normally, if you're charged with a crime, you appear in federal district court. The clerk will stand up and say, United States of America versus Richard Walton, wherefore United States comes and pleads against defendant in the following matters. That is your classic form. We are now seeing an alternative system of justice being at least put forward for trying the terrorists which are being held down at Gitmo. That's a military tribunal system. Let me point out just a few key areas in which military tribunals differ from our traditional federal courts. And I might add that we now have the right to hold people indefinitely without a showing of cause if they're connected with a terrorist group. We'll get to that in just a second. How are military tribunals different from our federal district court? One, you only need a two-thirds majority to convict. Now, in the United States system of justice, the federal system still requires a unanimous jury to convict you. I heard F. Lee Bailey talk on this, the famous trial lawyer, and he made probably the best argument I've ever heard in support of it. He put it this way. He said, sometimes when you come to me with a case, you, of course, are innocent. You always are. And you give me the facts of the case. I can send 50 law clerks down to Harvard Law School to research law for you. I can turn the air sparkling over the jury box on closing. But if I don't have a unanimous jury, you don't change your plans to leave town. For the simple reason that there may be only one or two people on that jury that, as Mr. Bailey puts it, that he can find to talk to their minds, to try to convince them of your case, of the merits of your case. And he says, as I heard him put it, he said, do not take away from me the most powerful weapon I have that could save your life. Two-thirds majority allows a majority of the jury to convict you, not a unanimous jury, which we've classically had in this country and which often can save a criminal from conviction. But while we're on the topic of juries, is this a jury of your peers, as the Constitution guarantees? Of course it's not. It is a panel of senior military officers. Now, if you if your name is Osama, you wear a sheet for a hat, and you have been plotting nefarious activities against the United States, I can think of a lot of juries I would rather appear before, however lousy my case might be, than a panel of military officers. All right? Very unsympathetic jury in cases like this, and a huge difference from what we traditionally have. Finally, there is a couple of other points I want to make. You can get the death penalty from this court with no right of appeal, which is always fun. You stand up. Traditionally in federal court, the judge says, Mr. Walton, the state is pleased to inform you that we will be gassing you just as soon as we can arrange it. I say, thank you, Your Honor. I will be appealing to the United States Supreme Court just as soon as my attorney can wake up and file the appeal. That doesn't work anymore. What these officers, two-thirds majority of military officers, can impose the death penalty on you with no right of appeal, and guess what? The proceedings are held in secret. So your family, your mother, your father, your significant other, your cute little children at home, literally won't know what happened to you. One day you get arrested, you're taken down to Gitmo, you're carried around with a sack on your head, you go before this smiling jury of friendly people, they on a two-thirds majority send you off to get hung, and the records from the thing are secret. There's no way the press or anybody else can review what happened there. It's a scary system of justice. Basically, to put it in a nutshell for you, it's the Star Chamber in the 21st century. This is the Inquisition all over again. Very justified. Personally, I think the terrorists deserve exactly what the military tribunals are going to give them. And in fact, the military tribunals, for reasons we won't go into, may be the only way to get this done. But don't miss the significance of what you are seeing. Even during the Civil War, the United States Supreme Court said you can't do this. So long as the civil courts are around, you can't have a military tribunal just because of these reasons. We're seeing it happen. We're seeing it happen in America. Don't overestimate the constitutional protections you have. This system, at this point, is limited to the bad guys, to the terrorists. But never forget that the only thing which separates you from this system is somebody's determination that you're not a terrorist. As soon as they think you are, you can find yourself in that thing, and God help the person that ends up there. Okay, moving on, let's move through the last little bit of our material. Let's talk about the Patriot Act. I don't know how many of you have even heard about that thing, recently passed in Washington, the USA Patriot Act. Okay, at least a few of you. Basically, it's a large piece of very comprehensive legislation designed to give the federal agencies broad powers to combat terrorism. Once again, a very needed piece of legislation. Let me just outline for you four areas in which I believe the Patriot Act could potentially be worrisome. Number one, and I will take questions on this if you're interested, is immigration. Immigrants have always had very few rights in this country. The INS is a great example of how not to run a government. But the standard used to be you could be deported for being a terrorist. That's always been the law in this country. If the government could establish you were a terrorist, out you go. You know, one-way ticket, thanks for coming, bring your money next time. That now has changed. Under the Patriot Act, any association with a group which is defined as terrorist equals automatic per se deportation with no right of appeal. Now, why is that worrisome? Think back just a few years. You remember South Africa. You remember apartheid and the segregation. Literally, apartheid was classified as a terrorist association. If you were a member of that, you could be deported now under this statute. So there's very little limitation on this. It's a fairly porous standard. It has a huge potential for being abused. Number two, there is now a sneak and peek capability, so-called, for federal warrants, and that can be used on anyone. That can be used on you or me. It is not limited to terrorists. So long as, there's no need to show probable cause, so long as one of our FBI agents can show that they need to execute the warrant without telling the person, they just go into their home, rifle through their things in secret, and then leave before they come home, they now have the capability to do that, so long as the federal agent can show that it's needed, otherwise the investigation will be in jeopardy. In other words, the standard is, if you don't do this, the investigation could be in jeopardy. That applies to you. It's a fairly scary expansion of federal powers. It used to be you had to get a Class 2 warrant and jump through a lot of hoops. That's no longer the case. Point number three, Federal Intelligence Security Act. Very briefly, this thing applies to anybody so long as the federal agency can show you are an agent of a foreign power. So literally, or a foreign organization. Literally, if you were a member of Amnesty International, you would be an agent of a foreign-based organization. This thing allows the government to bypass the probable cause requirements. Now, I'm not going to go into what those are. Suffice it to say, that has been a huge protection for you under the Fourth Amendment. It requires the government to go in and actually show cause, to show a reason to intrude into your home, into your life. Under FISA now and Patriot Act, they don't have to show probable cause so long as they establish that you're an agent of some foreign organization. Four, there are now breaches of the attorney-client privilege. That is probably the scariest of the bunch. The prisoners which are being held at Gitmo, other detainees in the September 11th investigation, the communications which they send to their attorney regarding their defense, which classically in American and British law have been absolutely privileged. As your attorney, I can walk into a court of law, I can be questioned by anybody, I can be questioned by the judge, And so long as my client has not waived the privilege, I can say, Your Honor, I refuse to answer that because it's a breach of the attorney-client privilege. You don't get around that thing. Literally, attorneys can walk into jails with closed briefcases because there's confidential attorney-client materials in there. Suddenly now we have the federal government breaching this privilege because they feel there's a danger that the client, who is also wearing a sheet around his head and may like a guy named Osama, maybe trying to plot further terrorist activities. Very, very scary abridgment of your rights. Four things you should know about the Patriot Act. There's a lot more. Overall, it's a wonderful piece of legislation. It gives our agencies all the power that they very badly need to track down these terrorists. At the same time, just be aware of some of the areas in which it can impact your life. Finally, and very briefly, let's talk about religious freedom. This is going to be a very quick trip through First Amendment jurisprudence for you. For those of you who never wanted to go to law school, I apologize, but hopefully you'll be able to get at least the bottom line. And so in the interest of giving you that before I bore you to death, the bottom line is religious freedom in America is for the most part a dead letter. Back in 1636, a guy by the name of Roger Williams was up in Massachusetts Bay Colony, kicked out by the Puritans for trading with Indians and, you know, several other egregious abuses. As he walked out into a cold New England winter to form what would become Rhode Island, he uttered into American history and thought a statement that has become a cornerstone of American jurisprudence. He said, "There must ever be a wall of separation between church and state." That sentiment was echoed by Thomas Jefferson. It was zealously enforced by the Warren Court. It has become an absolute cornerstone of American First Amendment jurisprudence. Wall of separation between church and state no longer exists. Chief Justice Rehnquist has said it is a bad rubric, one that is useless as a matter of constitutional law. It should be frankly and explicitly abandoned, which is exactly what the court has done. Back in the 1950s, there was a young gal by the name of Adele Sherbert who was Seventh-day Adventist. And she refused to work on Sabbath. Her boss thought that was not funny at all and fired her. She appealed to the State Board of Unemployment Compensation. That board denied her unemployment benefits, saying that she had been fired for cause. They said not working on Sabbath on Saturday was a for-cause reason to be terminated. She went all the way up to the Supreme Court. The Supreme Court said, "Oh, no, you don't. Ms. Sherbert is engaging in free exercise of her religious beliefs. The only way you can cut off her unemployment benefits is if you show a compelling governmental interest." In other words, they are stopping crime, they are saving lives, that sort of thing. Some compelling governmental interest for doing this. The State Board of Unemployment Compensation could not do that, and so Ms. Sherbert got her unemployment benefits. That became black-letter American constitutional law. About 30 years later, in the 1980s, there were a couple of young guys by the name of Galen Black and Alfred Smith. They were American Indian, and part of their religious experience required them to chew peyote, which is a hallucinogenic drug. If you don't know American Indian religion, basically the thought is that you communicate with the Great Spirit, and the Great Spirit sends you visions, and just in case the Great Spirit is having a bad day, you'd better chew a little something that, you know, gets you in the right frame of mind for the visions to come. Mr. Smith and Mr. Black, who ironically enough worked as drug counselors for the state of Oregon, went to one of their religious powwows, you know, chewed a little grass, and went back on Monday morning feeling very refreshed. I suppose they had their vision. Well, they walked in that morning, and their boss said, "Good news, guys, today is your day for the random drug test." Well, of course, they flunked. They were promptly terminated. They applied to the Oregon State Board of Unemployment Compensation. Once again, they said, "This is a for-cause termination. Sorry, you don't get benefits." And so Mr. Smith and Mr. Black did a very smart thing. They said, "Those four magic words that can change your life, I want my lawyer. They got in the phone book, they looked up an attorney, and the attorney looked at their case, and he said, guys, you got nothing to worry about. You see, there was this Adventist gal named Adele Sherbert. This is a slam dunk case. They took it all the way up to the Supreme Court. A new Supreme Court, the Rehnquist Court, overturns Sherbert, takes this standard out, and says, now, any governmental interest will justify this type of intrusion on a person's religious beliefs. They changed the standard for state intervention in religious free exercise of religious belief from compelling governmental interest to any governmental interest, even if it appears to be pretextual, so long as the state government can say, we think we can accomplish this, they're going to pass under this standard. Very porous, very low standard. Well, Congress took a look at this thing and said, oh, no, you don't. We like Sherbert. We think you're out to lunch. And they passed in 1995 the Religious Freedom Restoration Act, which overturned Smith and reinstated Sherbert. Problem is, under an old Supreme Court case called McCullough v. Maryland, you can't do that. When the Supreme Court pronounces unconstitutional law, Congress is out. Zip. They can't overturn it. Case comes back up. Catholic Church down in Texas wanted to do some expansion. There were some zoning conflicts. That was a case called City of Bernie v. Flores, if you're interested in noting these case names down. And that case went up to the Supreme Court. The Supreme Court overturned the Religious Freedom Restoration Act, said, no, you don't. This is the standard. That's the standard we have on the books right now. Ladies and gentlemen, the wall of separation between church and state, which we have classically relied on as Seventh-day Adventists, is getting very, very thin. This court is putting a lot of hold into the religious protections which allowed us to meet today and to worship the Lord as we chose. One other thing worth mentioning, and then I'll get off this topic. While all of this was going on, in Maryland there was a little sectarian college that had decided that they wanted money from the state of Maryland. They thought they were entitled to federal grants. But under the federal law, you had to prove that you were not pervasively sectarian in order to get this money. That seemed like a grand idea to them. And so they went to court and they said to the state of Maryland, you have to give us this money because we're not pervasively sectarian. Some of the things they required their students to do was attend Friday evening worships, take a certain number of religion classes, they had discriminatory hiring practices favoring people from their religion, et cetera, et cetera. All of these factors were considered by the court. The district court said, sorry, you can't do it. You're pervasively sectarian. They appealed to the Fourth Circuit. The Fourth Circuit said, you are not pervasively sectarian. You can get federal money. The name of that case is Columbia Union College. Versus Clark. Our own college in this time was attacking what had been a fairly solid protection against federal money going to our schools or our institutions. Now, what's the problem with federal money in places like CUC? The problem is, where goes federal money, there goes federal control. Once the federal government has a piece, so to speak, of CUC, they can demand changes in things like how we hire people, who we hire, when we can permit them to work, so forth and so on. This is a very sad case. It's a very sad chapter in Adventist history, and it certainly is sad to have to include that in a series of cases which have chipped away at Mr. Williams' wall of separation. All right, let me wrap up, conclude here, then we'll take your questions on anything you want to ask about. Whether we've talked about it this weekend or not, you've got questions about the church, questions about life, pitch them my way, and I will do my best to look smart and give you some sort of an answer. In closing, let me say, if you look at all this, it can look very discouraging. It can look as though a lot of the civil and religious liberties that we've enjoyed in this country are either being chipped away at or are disappearing. While there are certainly dangers out there, this is still the greatest nation on earth. There is an enormous institutional friction against some of the things I've talked about. While the legal standards are no longer there, thanks to cases like CUC v. Clark, there is, I think, a large amount of institutional restraint on the part of people in the Supreme Court, people at Justice. And I've heard Mr. Chertoff, Mr. Thompson, and others repeatedly say, we have this power, but we're not going to use it, or we're going to use it in a responsible way, which I believe. These are good people trying to do a good thing. Just remember, whenever you are counting on the restraint of individuals, that's a very poor protection. We as lawyers like black letter standards that we can rely on. Those standards are no longer there. When the time of crisis comes, ladies and gentlemen, things like the Sunday law are all too easy to get through. Don't let anybody tell you otherwise. We've seen this type of thing in the past, and if we believe Revelation, we'll see it again. Having said that, I'm very optimistic about this country, about where it's going. I've never been prouder to be an American, and as a Christian, I can look at all this stuff and not be discouraged. Because of that wonderful passage that we just had read to us a few minutes ago, says in Luke, when these things begin to come to pass, don't look down, don't get discouraged, look up, because your redemption is drawing nigh. There's a lot of courage that we can draw from this as Adventists. It's time to wake up, it's time to realize where we are in Earth history, where our country is going, get our heads out of the ruts we bury ourselves in, get them into this book, and start to prepare ourselves for the end. Because I do think it's coming very soon. I think the Lord is coming, and that we really need to be prepared to see His face. Perhaps Ellen White put it, in fact, she did put it more succinctly than I ever can. In Volume 8 of the Testimonies, page 28, transgression has almost reached its limit. Confusion fills the world, and a great terror is soon to come upon human beings. The end is very near. We who know the truth should be preparing for what is soon to break upon the world as an overwhelming surprise. Thanks very much. We got one more session together tomorrow morning. Really looking forward to seeing you then. It's great to be working with Al again. He's just a wonderful person. I've known him now for, I guess, 20 years. Al and Marion, thank you so much for your ministry throughout the years. You've just been a blessing in my life and a blessing in so many others. Really appreciate it. Thank you. All right, now here comes the fun part. Any question you want to ask about tonight's presentation, anything we've talked about, please feel free. We'll bring the mic to you. Don't be bashful. There are no dumb questions. Fire away. I'm here, and I'm looking forward to hearing what you have to say. Questions, comments, criticisms, please send them up. Get some hands. All right, we got one back here.
It's just a comment regarding tonight's talk. When you were asking the four volunteers whether they would torture or not, just in the context of what's going on, you know the person has information that's vital to the protection of so many lives. Would torture necessarily be cruel and unusual in that situation?
Interesting constitutional argument. We have a budding lawyer in the audience.
No.
Under those circumstances, query under constitutional theory, just to make sure everybody did hear the question, basically the issue posed is, if you have one guy that's got this information, there's thousands of lives at stake, is it cruel and unusual punishment under the Constitution to, you know, put foul-smelling bags on their head and drive sterilized needles under their fingernails? That is something that I think most constitutional scholars would tell you will very much have to be a case-by-case determination. I think very few people agree with Professor Dershowitz that we should institutionalize torture and actually provide a warrant for it. I mean, certainly if there's a nuclear bomb in New York and one person knows where it is, it's very possible to foresee federal officers really crossing the line to get that information. And in all likelihood, there's a chance that that act would be upheld under those circumstances. My own feeling is that torture in this country is never justified. I think the Constitution, if you look at the preamble, if you look at the Bill of Rights, was written to prevent something like that from ever happening in this country again. The basic question you're posing is the ultimate oxymoron. Is it possible to sacrifice liberty to save liberty? I submit to you that is always an unconscionable bargain. The liberties that we have at this point and the liberties we're so ready to throw away are liberties which Americans have died literally by the hundreds of thousands throughout the years to give us today. What we have today is built on the blood of an awful lot of very good people. Before we throw any of that away, before we abridge anybody's rights, however much of a scumbag they may be, we really need to honor their memory by giving it a serious, serious second thought. So the argument can be made. I probably would disagree with you, but if we ever come to that point, undoubtedly there will be very good lawyers saying things like that, and there's at least a chance that that argument would prevail. Yeah, that's a great point. Anybody else out there? I know there's lots of you just jumping out of your seats to say something. Yes, sir.
I just have a question, I guess, on the Sunday law.
Mm-hmm.
I guess legally, how quickly is it possible to be passed? Because in let me, how to put this? I mean, basically, realistically, in a terrorist attack or some kind of huge disaster, I know that things can be passed immediately. Is there any, I guess, can we bring that to like the Supreme Court? Like, has to be added amendment to the Constitution? What does it have to happen for it to happen? Do you know what I mean?
Yeah, certainly. I understand the question. The answer is in most cases, these laws, or at least in some cases, these laws don't have to be passed. They're already on the books. If you research, if you go down to the law library, the public law library in your county, look up your state codes, look for blue laws, you will undoubtedly find a law. In fact, I think New Jersey has one. A Sunday law requiring observance of the Sunday, of Sunday as a day of rest. They're no longer enforced. They are on the books. In a time of terminal crisis, those laws can be dusted off almost instantaneously. In terms of instituting a national Sunday law, that can happen, as we saw with the 11th, very, very quickly. Congress was in session when Flight 77 went into the Pentagon, just literally within sight of the Capitol. Congress reconvened the next day and was fulfilling its job of making the laws of this great nation. In the event of another such catastrophe, if there was a public sentiment for a Sunday law, which there very well could be, remember the vast majority of people in this country are Protestants who go to church on Sunday or believe that they should. In a time like that, people can get very angry very quickly, and the logic would probably go something like, this is a Christian nation, things were better when we were all in church on Sunday, those who don't want to go along can just get out. And that's when you see very hasty, very ill-conceived legislation. In a case like that, you can have Congress, presuming it's still around, in session the next day, you can have a bill out literally the day it happens or the day after it happens. At that point, it becomes the law of the land. It will be enforced until somebody conscientiously objects. They say, I'm not going to go along with this. At that point, federal marshals will come knocking on their door and say, Mr. Walton or Ms. Kim, would you please come with me? And while you're at it, can you do this? They will, cuff you, take you off to jail. You will hopefully bring a writ of habeas corpus. Or some other, or you will wait until your criminal trial and you will defend on the ground that the law is unconstitutional. You will probably lose in that type of climate, and you will go all the way up to the United States Supreme Court and get a verdict. The Supreme Court, however, cannot hear cases. They have to wait until there's an issue pending before them. They can't just decide constitutional law unilaterally. So it's going to take some nice Adventist person getting arrested and then getting a very mean lawyer like me to go and say something, hopefully, that would be a good argument before the Supreme Court. Other questions? Very good question. Yes? Let me get you the mic so we can get it on tape, and everybody out there can hear the question as well.
What has been the response of Sabbath-keeping Jews on this issue at all? Have they looked into the Sunday law, to the point where Adventists are concerned with it?
Not so much that I'm aware of. I'm not. I can't speak for the entire Jewish community. I am active with the Jewish law students at Georgetown, and for the most part, Jews do take a great interest in civil and religious liberty because they, more than any other group, have very short collective institutional memories to times when they didn't have these kind of protections. So, undoubtedly they are concerned about this, and they certainly have lobbying groups which operate with ones we run in defense of religious liberty in general. In terms of a, large uprising among Jews on the issue, I'm not aware of that. It certainly doesn't mean it isn't out there. Questions? Comments? Anything we've talked about this weekend? Friday night on, I just want to make sure that there's no loose threads out there. We've covered an awful lot of very dense material. Friday night we talked about the effects of September 11th, where we fit in prophecy, how that ties in. This afternoon we discussed some doctrinal issues, the sanctuary, the 2300 days, and certainly, of course, this evening, some legal and civil issues. That's a lot of material. I am rather puzzled that there are not more questions, unless I've been far clearer than I usually am. Anything else out there? Anything I can clarify? As I say, there's not a dumb question. Well, I see. You all want to go play basketball. Good luck to you. There are some of us who, believe it or not, find these sort of things incredibly fascinating. And it's really been a pleasure being with you. I've had a lot of fun. And we'll look forward to seeing you in the morning. Have a great night.
You've been listening to another special American Cassette Ministries presentation. This is a digital recording for optimum sound quality. International Copyright 2002, American Cassette Ministries, all rights reserved. For additional cassettes by this speaker or for a free catalog of other American Cassette Ministry cassettes, please contact us as follows. To order toll-free in the United States and Canada, dial 800-233-4450. For international calls, dial 717-652-7000. For fax orders, dial 717-652-9050. Our internet email address is info@americancassette.org. Other cassettes may also be ordered from our secure website at www.americancassette.org. Our entire catalog is online, and we accept MasterCard, Visa, and Discover credit cards. Or you may simply write to American Cassette Ministries, Post Office Box 922, Harrisburg, Pennsylvania, 17108 in the United States of America. Maintaining the integrity of the Three Angels' messages for 27 years, American Cassette Ministries requests your continued prayers and financial support as we strive to provide you with the finest, most powerful spiritual messages available. Our one purpose in ministry, to prepare you and your loved ones to meet Jesus Christ. He's coming soon.